Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I am Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and we've got a brilliant, brilliant episode for you today. We got three fantastic writers. We're gonna be hearing later in the podcast from Arne Dahl, who's a Nordic crime superstar. We also have on the podcast Kate Tuch, who has got a book called Head for the Edge, Keep Walking. Brilliant title for a book, and I really love talking to Kate, and I hope you enjoy it too. But we're going to start today's podcast with a fantastically fun interview about forensics with Val McDermott and Sue Black. Now, everybody probably knows Val McDermott as a legendary crime writer from here in Scotland. She teamed up with Sue Black, who is a professor of forensics at Dundee. And we have a really great conversation about crime, crime writing, morbid stuff, but with a whole lot of laughter, surprisingly. So here we go, Val McDermott and Sue Black.
Hi, I'm Val McDermott, the author of Forensics, the Anatomy of Crime.
And I am Professor Sue Black, so I'm a forensic anthropologist and I'm an anatomist at the University of Dundee.
The original idea for the book came from the Wellcome Trust, who have a big museum of medical history in London, and they wanted to refurb the collection and reopen with a big exhibition about forensics, the history and practice of it. And they wanted a book to accompany this, and they came to me and said, we'd like you to do a book about forensics. And I burst out laughing and said, basically, why me? I just make stuff up. You know, I write fiction. I'm not a scientist. But they persuaded me eventually that I could return to my old days as a journalist and go and interview the leading forensic scientists in a variety of disciplines, look at the history of those disciplines and look at where those disciplines are going, and pull something together that sits alongside the exhibition. It's not a catalogue, but it's a book that takes you through where forensic science is and how it got there. I think they were interested in my work, particularly because I use forensic science quite a lot in the course of my novels. I like to think that I use it in quite a light-handed way. I'm not ramming the science down people's throats. But thanks to people like Sue and Niamh, I have, I think, quite a strong layperson's understanding. And I think in my crime novels, I communicate that quite well to the readership. And the Wellcome Trust wanted someone who could essentially communicate to people who are not scientists what this is all about, how it works, how these things are done. And I guess they figured that somebody who wasn't a scientist could perhaps communicate it more readily to other lay people than someone who was perhaps a little bit more wrapped up in the actual technical science.
Val McDermott has been abusing me horrendously for many, many years.
And
I've got used to the abuse, I have to say, and welcome it much of the time. And it started off that we first met, although it was a virtually meeting, it was on a radio show. And I think you were in Manchester and I was in Aberdeen. And it was that time when you're waiting off air, just, you know, chatting away. And I made an absolutely critical mistake. I made the mistake of saying, if there's anything you think I can ever help you with, just give me a call. And, you know, it's like a marriage in that 15 years later, she's still hanging around. And so what we've got, I think, is a very good relationship. It's gone over a very long period of time. It's a relationship that's matured, I think, quite extensively, because, it's quite difficult at the early stages. You think, a crime writer, how on earth could I trust someone like a crime writer? They make it up. But as time has gone on, I've increased enormously my respect for a lot of the crime writers, not all of them, by any means, but a lot of the crime writers, and Val in particular, takes a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous amount of time to research what she's going to write. So there's a great deal of respect that Val pays to her readers. And as a scientist, we understand that respect and we understand that care and attention. So I've got to a point in my career and my relationship with Val where there's an element of trust now, so that I know that if she's going to come looking for a story, it might be in relation to a case that I'm working on that is currently active, but I have the faith and trust and know that she will in fact turn that around so that it's not identifiable as what I'm actually looking at, but the core of the story is there. So she's very trustworthy in that regard as a writer in my books.
That's interesting. It's very interesting. I didn't even think about that idea, that notion that you needed to trust Val, not to kind of take stories verbatim. And what's that like on the other side? Did you feel like a need to trust Sue in any way, or did you just kind of be like, whatever, if you're a scientist, you'll give me the straight dope?
For me, one of the great things that I realized right from the get-go, that very first time that we spoke, that we took part in the same radio show, that Sue has a tremendously valuable quality as a scientist. She has the ability to translate what she knows into terms that people who are not scientists can understand. So I'll give you an example. Some years ago, I rang Sue up and I said, I'm writing about a body that's been in a peat bog for 200 years. What's it going to look like after 200 years in a peat bog? And there was a moment's pause. And then she said, a leather bag with a face on. And that's such a vivid image right there. And I didn't have to do any work. I just dropped that straight into the book. So from very early on, I understood that Sue was somebody who was not going to be trying to blind me with science. She has the ability of the true educator, the desire to share, the desire to make you understand. And for me, that was incredibly valuable. But I also think that one of the things that right from the get-go, we connected as human beings as well within a very short space of getting to know each other. We would talk about our families, we'd talk about our home lives as well as our professional lives. And there was a real sort of understanding, I think, that built up between us and the trust of friendship that underpins, I suppose, the professional trust.
Is that typically how it works? You've got a scene which requires massive amount of blood or guts or whatever. You call up and you say, how is this anatomically possible? How is this forensically possible? Is that the way it typically works?
She does it a number of ways. She's a little bit sneaky. She's like the assassin that comes in, you know, just out of left field. So that if she's got a particular story she's working on and she's got something very specific she wants to ask, then you'll get the straight questions. What will this look like? What would it smell like? How's it going to appear? And you can paint the story. And then you get the days when she's on a fishing expedition. So she will phone up and it will very much be a chit chat and how's the husband? How's the kids? How's the everything else? Are you working on anything interesting right now? And before you know it, you've started to tell her what it is you're doing. And if she's quick enough, it ends up in her books before the research ends up in my journals. So that, I've learned whether she's on the fishing expedition or there's a very direct question coming. It works both ways.
That's what makes the books come alive for the reader. That's what makes the fiction come alive. It's not a sort of dry recitation of the facts of it. You know, you can go through all the, if you like, the facts of the forensic science, and that's fine. You're giving your reader information. But what makes it come alive is what I like to think of as the sociology of the information. It's like, you know, for example, we're talking about fire alarms and smoke alarms and why people don't necessarily wake up. And then it suddenly becomes, it spins off into this very human story about small children won't wake up for a smoke alarm, but they will wake up to the sound of their mother's voices. So you have this whole idea, it becomes then a human dimension that means when you tell something like that, the reader connects with that as a human being, as a parent, as somebody who understands children, whatever. You get a sense of how this fits into the world. It's not just, here's a piece of information. Because of the way that I network, this book came together through a series of people who are passionate about what they do. So it's like I'd be talking to Sue about what she does and I'll go like, I still need a toxicologist and I still need a this. I say, do you know anybody that's good, that anybody that'd be a good chat? And so it's that word of mouth. Once you get connected to one or two people in the business, as it were, you get to know very quickly people who are good communicators, people who will take the time and the trouble to explain what they're doing to someone like me. And so I managed, I think, to avoid the ones that are kind of more difficult to deal with, shall we say, or more difficult to extract information from. So I'm like water. I run downhill. I take the easiest route.
As you were putting the book together, were you finding yourself stopping and going, this is a great story. I need to use it. But you're burning it by putting it in. Are you burning the material by putting it in forensics? Or can you use the material again later on for your own novels and your own creative purposes, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of stuff you can always just rejig and come at it from a different angle. But there is stuff that genuinely there wasn't room for in the book or it just didn't fit with the narrative of the non-fiction book. So there's lots of bits and pieces tucked away in my back pocket that will reemerge at some point.
Sue, I know a lot of your work, I mean, you're dealing with death, but you also seem very lively, everybody seems very lively, and there's a gallows humor here. But how do you reconcile those two things?
There is no doubt there's a gallows humor is always associated with anything in the forensic world that is associated with death. It is not a disrespect. It is a coping mechanism. And so in, for example, in Kosovo in the mortuary, there would be a tremendous amount of laughter within the team. The minute somebody comes into the room that is not a part of your team, the atmosphere changes right there and then, because we're conscious that we have a comfort within our team, that it's accepted that what we're doing is just getting through a day from hell. And sometimes you just need to do that with some humour. The humour is never directed at the deceased. It's usually at each other. So, for example, when we were out in Kosovo, we had a brand new radiographer who'd never been out in the field before. And what we did is we took a bullet and we taped it underneath the table so that whilst he's going through with the X-ray machine, he can see the bullet. But of course, we can't find the bullet in the body because it doesn't exist in the body. And he's going mad because he's thinking, I'm really an amateur here. What are they going to be thinking about him? And we just taped the bullet underneath the table. He'd not thought about it. And that's not doing anything that is disrespectful. It's just about saying, if you can get through the black humor, you're part of the team, and the team will need to do this to cope. When we're in those sort of circumstances, we can't carry the guilt, okay? So we didn't cause it. We're not responsible for it. It's our job very specifically to go out there, to gather the evidence, to analyse the evidence, interpret it and present it. It's not ours to have an opinion on was somebody guilty, was somebody innocent, was this right, was this wrong. And there is an element of compartmentalisation that you just have to do.
There's a crucial thing at play here, and that is that the ability to differentiate between the job you're doing and the human beings that you're doing it with. And it's that issue of, and I think the same thing's often true of writers, we take the job that we do very seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously at all, because that's how you get through it. Yeah, that's how, and one of the reasons I think crime writers are you know, the most mentally healthy group in the literary world. You know, we are the party animals of the literary world. We do all the dark stuff on the page, and then we put that to one side and we take the mickey out of each other all the time.
Yeah, it's always been such a pleasure talking to any crime writer and stuff, and Bloody Scotland sounds like it must be a blast.
See, it's not, the poets just whinge a lot, you know. The poets whinge a lot, and the literary novelists are always backbiting and bitching, but we're basically saying, whose round is it?
Yeah.
Get them in.
And it's never the one from Fife. It's never the one from Fife that buys a round. Never.
Val McDermott and Sue Black, everybody. Forensics, The Anatomy of Crime from Val is available everywhere. Go out and get yourself a copy. It's a fascinating read. You can also follow Val on Twitter at Val McDermott. I'm sure she'd appreciate a follow. Go look her up as soon as you can. Up next on the podcast, we've got Kate Tuch, whose debut novel is Head for the Edge, Keep Walking. We caught up with her ahead of her appearance at the I Write Festival in Glasgow, where she'll be appearing and reading from her novel. So make sure to check her out there. And in fact, make sure to go to the I Write Festival. It's one of my favorite book festivals happening in Scotland. It's a really, really warm, convivial atmosphere. It takes place in the beautiful Mitchell Library. It's going to be happening from the 17th of April to the 25th of April. Make sure to check out their program at iwrite.com. So now, Head for the Edge, Keep Walking with Kate Tuch.
So the book is about a woman called Jill Beach, who's 30-something. She's surrounded by a few friends of similar age. You kind of jump into her life at a point where it's just on the downslide, and her friends are kind of on the upslide and starting to sort their lives out, and Jill's is just unravelling before our very eyes. She has dodgy smear test results, which isn't an uncommon thing, and you go through the cervical examination machine in the NHS when you get a dodgy smear result, and hers looks like it's okay, but actually turns out it's not okay. She changes jobs, and it's, you know, it's a habit she has of just changing jobs and see if that will brighten life up a bit, but it you know, it's the same old. So she ends up in a job that's no better than the last one, with a major health issue and no husband, no children, and all her friends are merrily skipping off into the sunset. It's kind of a slightly delayed quarter-life crisis.
And I really, one thing that I thought just was super interesting, and we'll get into some of the other stuff, but just the setting of just putting her in a relatively normal working environment. You know, it's not a novel that's by an author who's writing about another author. You know, was this how conscious of a choice was it to set it in a just a very normal office setting, and how hard was that? Because most people, I think, would resist that because it seems too normal, too boring, you know, that kind of thing.
There's kind of a journey how she ended up with that being a feature of her story. So obviously this is written in first person, and when I sat down to start writing this voice, I didn't know I was writing a novel. I was on a master's degree. I was a short story writer and a poet. And I thought, well, you're on a master's, you should experiment and do the thing you don't normally do and test yourself. So go beyond 3,000 words and just see what that's like. And, you know, that was the kind of worst and best decision I ever made, because once you get so far beyond 3,000 words, you've got too many words to then abandon. So you're kind of obliged to keep going with this monster that you've birthed. And it was on. It was another five-year journey, which if I'd known at the beginning, would I have carried on? I don't know. Anyway, started out in this first-person voice, which is a total cliche for a debut novel, but I wasn't writing a debut novel. I was just experimenting with a long, short story with a voice that I quite liked that I'd chanced upon. So because it was the first person, and I know the huge risk around writing first person is people are going to think, oh, this is you. So even if there was the slightest inkling that I wanted to make her someone stuck in a job that she didn't want but who actually wanted to be a writer, I was not going to touch that. I wasn't going near that, because that would have levelled the accusation at me, oh, it is about you and it's not about me. So I deliberately wanted to and the number of books that you do read, there was one I read in the summer, and I won't mention the author, but it's a good, very popular book, and it's that, exactly that. It's the characters unhappy with their life and annoyed with themselves because they've actually got more free time than they'll let on, and they should be using it to write, but they're not. They're avoiding it by getting drunk and eating pasta. And so I think it's overused, the idea that creative people write about creative. Not everybody in the world's desire is to be a writer. You know, some people just want a more satisfying job than they already have. Nowadays, as a writer, you don't tend to get to the stage of your first novel being out and without some support along the way from taxpayer-funded, amazingly skilled organisations that are out there. So one of the ones that helped me, it was High Arts, and they had a scheme called Work in Progress. You had to demonstrate that you were so far along on your journey as a writer. You weren't just waking up and thinking, oh, I fancy writing a book. So if you could demonstrate that you had committed enough of your time and energy to producing a book, then they offered an appraisal service for free. So I had my novel appraised by an anonymous person through the High Arts scheme. It was so positive and so helpful, and she said, you're so nearly there, you know, but I can see why you're struggling with this, or maybe the beginning, or maybe the... And one of the things she said was the theme of Jill having a job, which is kind of in there. I love the scenes of her at work, and could you just make that one of the themes of the book? Because I think you're missing something if you just have her turning up at a job and these tantalising scenes of her at work, and then the main meat is all somewhere else. Actually make her work life a theme, which fits really nicely, because one of the dilemmas, the reason you end up in these generations, the reason you end up in your mid-30s, childless and unmarried and packing it all into 3 years, and is because work is the main focus of every young person's life now. So you kind of sleepwalk through this career or this vocational existence and then realise there's other things that should have had attention paid to them. But there is a point, I've said this at the Edinburgh Book Festival, there's a point where readers get thoroughly annoyed with this character. You can't help it. It's so immediate. The first person voice is so intimate and immediate that you are the journey with her. You are her, basically. And then there's a point where we can't live like this anymore. And I want the reader to feel that as well. You know, get over it, or sort it out, or, but, you know, give yourself a shake, because we can't live like this anymore. I can't read any more of this in a good way.
And you're going to be at the I Write Festival in April, right?
Yep, Saturday the 18th, I think that's the first Saturday, and I'm paired with a woman called Sue Lawrence, who was a MasterChef winner and has turned from cookery books to fiction, so it should be interesting.
Kate Tuch, everybody, make sure to catch her at I Write. In fact, make sure to get along to the entire 9-day festival. I'm sure there's something there for everybody and all interest. Remember, it's from the 17th of April to the 25th of April. It will be absolutely brilliant. Make sure you get yourself along to Glasgow. Lastly on the podcast, we've got an interview with one of Scandinavia's most major crime writers. Now, Sasha De Boule captured this great interview, but the first thing she needed to establish, of course, is whether or not his name was actually Arne Dahl.
My name is not Arne Dahl, really, but it's my pen name, so it's the name I write under. My real name is Jan Arnold, but that's not very important. As Arnedal, I've written 15 books of crime fiction, I think, now in Sweden, but unfortunately there are only 3 translated into English.
Could you tell us a little bit about the new book, To the Top of the Mountain, and maybe a little bit of background on the whole Intercrime series, because obviously it's the third book in the series.
Yeah, the Intercrime series is an attempt to write about a team rather than a single individual detective in the center of things. So it's more of a collective storytelling. They are a special force within the Swedish police, working especially difficult crimes, really, basically. And for me, it was important to create this team spirit that you get all these individuals very specific. It's supposed to be, you know, 7 protagonists, 7 lead characters. To the Top of the Mountain is the third book. The ones before were The Blinded Man was the first one, and then came Bad Blood. In Bad Blood, they are confronted with a very vicious American serial killer that comes to Sweden, and the group is actually put to rest at the end of that book. And when To the Top of the Mountain starts, the team does not exist anymore, but events make it necessary for them to reunite. And that's what happens in To the Top of the Mountain, which is about several different crimes, very different crimes. It starts out with a simple violent crime in a local pub in Stockholm. A guy gets a beer glass in the head and dies, and that's what these very qualified detectives have been doing since the end of the A unit. And now it turns out that behind this rather ordinary crime is hiding something more vicious, and there are several different crimes in this network of different crimes. Small crimes are always a sign of bigger crimes in one way or another, and that's really the story.
So was it sort of like getting the band back together? Like, is there a montage where they all meet up at the start?
No, they're actually working with very different things, and it turns out that some of these things are really big. There's a explosion in one of the high security prisons in Sweden, and a guy is actually blown up inside the prison, and that's turns out to be a guy who's close to a mafia constellation. And when it becomes clear that this is it's a little bigger than it looks from the beginning, then it's time for the unit to get back together again.
So do you think that there are things that crime fiction can do with its, you know, set structures and sort of the things that people expect from the genre that other genres can't do?
Yes, there is, of course, this promise in crime fiction, the promise that you will deliver some kind of answer. When you are thrust into this world of chaos and disorder and violence, there is always this hope or certainty that there will be an answer, there will be some kind of truth. And that's something that no other genre actually promises, a closure, an answer, a truth that you seldom get in your own life. And that's sort of appealing at the same time as it's a bit problematic that you always have to tie everything together and you can't leave any unresolved mysteries, because then you sort of wreck the whole genre and just crash it, which you can do, of course, but that wasn't interesting for me. It was more a question of how do you keep the important questions that you have asked alive after the book is over and you have tied all these threads together. How do you still make people think on? And that was sort of the biggest challenge, really. You have to ask such important contemporary social questions, political perhaps, moral questions, that they linger in your head after having gotten all the answers. That's what I really enjoy about this genre. Apart from the basic fact that they're always about life and death, you know, the most important things we have to talk about, the thin line between the living and the dying.
You've talked a lot about how much you feel crime fiction can do a lot within the genre. What got you started with writing crime? Like, have you always wanted to write crime? What do you love about it?
I noticed in Sweden especially, most crime fiction writers from the beginning came from journalism. They were journalists, crime reporters and so on that actually started writing crime fiction. So it was always a sort of journalistic genre in Sweden. That means that it was very realistic, very based on the sources being correct and so on. And I come from a slightly different place. I had written 4 books, I think, before I started writing crime fiction in my real name. So I just changed my name to start writing crime fiction, to write something completely different. Because what I did then was more, you know, experimental literature, poetry, quite different things, and I've kept doing that as well. But it surprised me when I started writing crime fiction, which I had read a lot when I was a kid, so I had the basic feeling for crime fiction, but I hadn't read it for a long time. But what surprised me when I started writing really 1 book a year for a long time, so it was a sort of continuous writing of crime fiction. What surprised me was that I didn't have so much need for the other genres anymore, because I could fit almost everything I wanted to say into the crime fiction genre. That surprised me a bit. I thought it was a bit narrower. It's a very flexible and very usable genre. You can use it for a number of purposes. My respect for the genre has grown all the time. I think you can fit almost all storytelling into the crime fiction genre. So, in this time that I've written my 15 books of crime fiction, I think I've written 4 novels in my real name as well. So, I guess crime fiction does satisfy my creative needs to a certain extent, yes.
And obviously you come from, you know, the Scandinavian and Nordic crime and noir scene, which has been hugely popular and it just seems to be growing and growing. Do you feel that that puts pressure on you as a writer, or do you feel like that is a positive thing for you as a writer?
I don't think it puts any pressure on me, really. I'm pretty new in this country, but I was one of the first, actually, who started writing this genre in I think I started writing in 96 or something, and the first book was published in 98. So no, I no pressure. But a bit of a surprise that it managed to stay alive for such a long time internationally. It started out with Henning Mankell, perhaps, in the mid-90s. And that was a big peak. And then we thought, from this peak, we will probably slide down now. But then came the second big peak, and that was Stieg Larsson. And since then, I guess you could probably say that there are too many Swedish writers writing crime fiction right now. And some people think that it's very easy to write crime fiction. And sometimes I think that we are lowering the standards of the genre a little bit by writing a little bit too much. But for me, it's no pressure at all. In the last 4 books, I've written more about Europe than about Sweden, actually. So I feel more like a European writer now. You have to be grateful at the same time. I mean, we had this tradition that was sort of parallel all the time, really, to the English and the Scotch. They're quite different, actually. And then there's the American, that's the third one. And then there was the Swedish one all the time from the 60s and on, but it was never discovered, and it was sort of just working in the darkness. And when it suddenly was clear that there was a second, or a quite a different tradition that was more perhaps socially critical, that's one of the keystones to Swedish crime fiction, when that was discovered, there was a lot to be discovered. But then there is a new wave of perhaps not so good crime fiction, if I may say so. In general, of course, it's fantastic as long as the interest in the world exists. So I'm just happy and I stick with it as long as I can.
You talked about the sort of social criticism element of Swedish crime fiction. I was going to say, obviously, that social criticism sits in part with also having to write scenes of, you know, at times extreme violence or gore do you think that in order for that to work, it always has to have a social slant to it, for it to, you know, that violence has a function rather than just being like gore for the sake of gore?
There is a tendency right now, and since perhaps 7 or 8 years, that you have to make it more and more gory. That's not really how the genre develops, that you just make it more and more horrible. To me, violence is a part of crime fiction. Without it, crime fiction loses a bit of its nerve and its intensity. You have to have the threat of violence, because it is one of the most important threats in the world in general. And it's our job to talk about violence in one way or another. But if you can put it in a social dimension as well, explain violence, perhaps even make it understandable, you sort of demystify violence as well. It's not a majestic supernatural evil. It's human beings forced to do evil things in one way or another for one or another reason. It becomes more efficient if it's also a way of telling the story of a society and where it's going. It's proven to be a very good genre for writing about social changes, good and bad, mostly bad, and a way to criticize politics, the way people rule this world, and how money always tends to be the root of all evil. So to me, violence is necessary. Gore is not necessary. Sometimes you need heavy violence because you're telling a story about big emotions one way or another. But it's not a value in itself. Never. Then it becomes just entertainment violence. It must fill a function in the storytelling. And if you have a good story that requires some heavy violence, then you shouldn't sort of dive away from it. Then you need it, and then you have to talk about it. And sometimes it's not necessary at all. You're telling another kind of story. So I'm not against using hard-boiled violence in books, but it must fill a function. That's it.
Arne Dahl, everybody. Thanks to him, and thanks to Sasha for picking up that fantastic interview. His latest book is called To the Top of the Mountain. Finally, before we go, we just need to let you know this is going to be the last of our regular episodes of Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. But do make sure to follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust, like us on Facebook, or check out our website, ScottishBookTrust.com, to keep track of all the exciting projects coming out of the Scottish Book Trust. There are many. Also, if you'd like to keep hearing the sound of my voice on a weekly basis, please check out our Culture Laser podcast. It features interviews with a wide array of artists, including contemporary authors and poets. We do sincerely hope you'll join us on our SoundCloud page, where you can follow us, or you can subscribe via iTunes, or you can keep in touch via Twitter. Our handle and our tweets come from @CultureLaser. We do look forward to sharing more interviews and more exciting audio shrapnel with you soon. That's all from us at Book Talk. For now, until later, happy reading.